There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of that kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Will.
Hey, guys.
And Jason.
Yo, Team Mordecai here.
Today we're looking at the Book of Esther in the King James Bible, continuing on in our Holy Bible Book Club. And my first question to the two of you and to anybody at home, why do you think this book made it into the final cut of the official Bible? Let's start with you, Will.
I don't have an answer, but that's a really great question. And I think it's something that is to the degree that I'd like to consider, you know, because it's not a very, I didn't get much out of it. I don't have an oral teaching. I didn't watch the 1 hour, one book video on it, which would have been great. no one told me what the point of this story is, right? And I think that that's something that's missing from our experience, is having that person who has been indoctrinated in the oral traditions as well as the written traditions and can explain to you the significance and the placement of a story like this. And, you know, there are references to myrrh and sweet odors that they use to purify virgins. And I think that's an interesting thing that was brought up during the whole Esther selection process. But it's a fun question to ask, you know, like it was an intentional creation, the Bible, certainly in the form that we're reading it. And there were many contenders to be in this book. So what do you think, Jason? Why did this book make the cut?
Well, I think kind of touching on that oral tradition, it gives a reason why we celebrate the Jewish people, the celebration of Purim, if I'm saying that right. Is a celebration where, you know, it wasn't in the Torah, but this section that we're starting to read after the Babylonian exile, after Ezra and Nehemiah, is part of the Bible called the Ketuvim in Hebrew. And one of the celebrations that's talked about at the end of this book, Esther, is Purim, where they celebrate the Jewish people overcoming kind of a genocide, essentially, because Xerxes' right-hand man was going to kill all the Jews. So I think that's kind of the official answer of why this book is in the Bible.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of, like, what else was, like, on the table to be put into the Bible, because it feels so different from the other stuff that we've seen, like, from Genesis to the stories of Kings, and, like, there wasn't many genealogies in this one, right? It was, like, it had a really proper story structure. Like, I've been reading this book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel, trying to figure out how to, you know, write stories and everything. And I was going through this book, I'm like, this one hits all the beats that it's talking about. It feels like a fiction story, but yeah, at the same time, like, Dr. Isaac Asimov calls it historical fiction, and he stresses that term in his Guide to the Bible. And I'm just thinking in my head, but as opposed to what exactly is the rest of the Bible?
Yeah, it does. It's kind of exciting and feels like a soap opera in a way. But the rest of the Bible before this, you know, the Torah from Genesis to, I guess, the Book of Kings, does feel separate the way it reads. And then these chapters, until we get to the New Testament, are kind of accounting for the period after the exile. And so they're a little bit, I don't know, each chapter is kind of discrete in its own way. but they are connected to the rest of it. Like in this book, it's connected in so much as like the king's right hand man,
Haman.
Haman, thank you. He is a descendant of the Agagites, which are a tribe that King Saul wiped out. They were the Amalekites. So an Agagite is like a king from the Amalekites, and he was, King Saul saved one of the kings. He killed everybody else but the king. And so this Haman is a descendant of that king that was saved. And if you go back all the way to Genesis, the Amalekites come from Jacob's brother Esau, which, you know, it was said that he's going to be a thorn in the side or a heel in the side of the Jews, and kind of a recapitulation of that.
That was very interesting. Thanks for tying that together, Jason. I feel like Scott took a low swing in trying to call the entire readings up until this point historical fiction and just threw that under. But like, compared to what would be, you know, like divine mythology, pseudo-documentation, right? Like it was historical fiction compared to that. Like there were, as we've seen, you know, archaeologically proven facts throughout the stories that have been shared. And while it delivers a whole bunch of, you know, things in a much more boiled down capacity, it's aiming at the truth, whereas this was like reading a story and there was no documentation and there was no details, right? Like no details and no reiteration and no mention of God. Like it was just a story.
That was one thing that kept coming up one after another. Every bit of research I did, it always popped up. The first thing they always said, this is the only book in the Bible that doesn't bring up God himself. So that's important, but it's also another reason to ask the question, why did this one make the cut?
And it's a juxtaposition too, when you know what comes next, putting Esther right beside Job. Like we see, this is a triumphant story. Whereas what we're about to get into with Job, that's another story as well, but it's an omnipotent and overseering type of story filled with destruction and shock and reward at the end, but tons of suffering. Whereas this, there's suffering nonetheless, but it feels a little bit more royal, I guess.
Do you guys think that God wasn't mentioned in this particular story because it's taking place in Persia, like outside of, you know, the God's chosen land?
I don't think that really has much to do with it because, you know, the beginning of the Bible, a lot of it's in Egypt, so God didn't really have much, like, sovereignty there at all, because they had their own set of gods, right? Or their own monotheistic set at the time. And then Moses had to leave before his God had any jurisdiction over the people, right?
This feels more like a Greek tragedy almost to me. Like it reads like, when you know about the backstory behind the names and the, like, you've got Xerxes, the god king, and then we've got Marduk and Ishtar references, and it's all very sexual, and there's it's like a pantheonic mythology epic in 10 pages.
Yeah, and there's a lot of evidence to say that this story is just leftover mythology from Babylonian myth. Like, when you look at Mordecai and Esther, it sounds a lot like Marduk and Ishtar, and their stories sound a lot the same too. And Asimov talks again about how Haman is the name of an Elamite deity and how the Babylonian gods came in and usurped the old Elamite pantheon there. So a story of one set of gods replacing another can easily be adapted for the Jews, saying, you know, this is Yahweh coming in and saying, I'm replacing what came before me too, so there's a lot you can get into there.
Yeah, it's almost like you could imagine if someone were to create a work like this now and try and scope all of human culture and civilization, there'd be necessary referential chapters that are just like shout outs to the Disney Cinematic Universe, for example, right? Like,
yeah.
But this is what they had to deal with, was civilizations and mythologies, and there was no Netflix. So when they went to write stories, you know, there was things that needed to be involved, and they wouldn't make sense a couple thousand years later. But at the time when you were writing it, it would be like, well, of course they wrote a story and they named them Esther and Mordecai. That's so brilliant. That's
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's an Easter egg.
Yeah, but at the same, like, it reminds me so much of the stories that at least I know and love today. Like, I look at Jack Kirby, for example. He came up with the superhero comic of the Mighty Thor. And, you know, that's just a blatant ripoff of Norse mythology. Like, every single issue, every story that he came up with, you know, he was just thumbing through the prose Edda or the poetic Edda or one of the sagas and saying, which story am I going to take inspiration from today? This is a good one. I can get at least 10, 12 issues out of this. One will just keep it running, and then, you know, all of the other Thor writers after him kept kept that same rhythm going. So
comic writers have been gender and race swapping, like, mythologies for decades.
Yeah.
You know, in the previous book of Ezra and Nehemiah, they showed that Cyrus the Great kind of was open to the Hebrew God and to all of the other gods in the area. But this this guy, Ahasuerus, is that how you say that?
Xerxes.
It's Ahasuerus. Xerxes. It's Ahasuerus or Xerxes.
They're like the same person, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, what kind of gods were they following as, you know, the...
They were...
Xerxes. I have no idea.
Now, they were Zoroastrians, I think. But, again, like, the god King Xerxes played a big role. And when I was watching that one-hour, one-book video that Will referenced earlier, he actually gave us a little timeline. So I'm going to do Jason's role in this one and give you some dates. So this was like 100 years after the Babylonian exile, but it's also like right after the Battle of the 300, like the Battle of Thermopylae. So this is at the point where Persia's kind of sitting on their asses, kind of feeling sorry for themselves. And Haman just says, I know what'll cheer our king up. I'll have him kill all the Jews or something, right?
Well, he wants to kill all the Jews because Mordecai won't bow down to him. Haman has like been raised up to above the prince level. He's like now the vizier, the second-hand man of Xerxes, and so everybody should bow down to him. And Mordecai's like, nah, I'm not going to treat you like a god or something like that. So he gets really pissed, and that's why he wants to kill Mordecai and all the rest of the Jews, basically commit genocide.
Yeah, and I had a question about that for you guys. Do you think that it was really like a personal vendetta against Mordecai, or do you think when he found out that it was, you know, like Hebrew doctrine to never bow to another man, because, you know, you should only do that for God, then he's just like, oh well, this culture, this way of life is no longer sustainable under the god King Xerxes, so that's why, like, they all need to be purged, not just like a... Because when I kept doing research about it, it was just like, oh, look at this petty guy just bitter and mad at Mordecai. But I really didn't see it that way. I saw it more of like a symbolic thing. Like, we're going to hang this guy who doesn't listen to our ways, and everyone else is going to see that as an example, because Mordecai is one of the respected guys among their people. So they'll see this as a warning, and then they'll, you know, back down.
I think it was a bit of both, honestly. I mean, the Jewish people, from Haman's perspective, were probably considered to be stubborn. Like, they go into detail of, like, these Jewish people won't follow the laws of our king. And
right.
So I think they probably feel that that's going to cause some kind of rebellion in the future, and they just want to go ahead and stomp them out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the quote was that we started with, right? Like, their laws are diverse from all people, and they don't keep the king's laws. Like, they might happen to comply with the laws of the king, but they're not, like, dutiful citizens. And that's what we see for a lot of these stories, like, with Cyrus and Darius and now Xerxes. Like, it's about domination and getting the taxes and having a sustainable system to continually, reliably get taxes from their subjects. So I think that like, economically was a huge driving factor from a prime minister essentially making a decree. Like, you gotta understand too, like, a king is still gonna be a figure and a symbol no matter what it is, and they're gonna have advisors, and that's what this guy is. And he's like, got a point, and it's fueled by his own prideful, wrathful vendetta, and he happens to make it a really good play, but it doesn't work for him.
Yeah, it probably didn't help either that King Xerxes seems like he's drunk for most of this book. Like, they throw a 6-month party or something right after the defeat in Athens. And that's when he calls out his wife and is like, bring out my wife, and, you know, make sure she's only wearing a crown, implying that she's going to be naked. And if she is supposed, no, Esther's supposed to represent Ishtar. So anyway, the wife refuses and basically is displaced. And
yeah, that actually ties in. I forgot to mention that Vashti, the queen that gets replaced, is also a direct name of an Elamite goddess. So in, like, the same pantheon as Haman, like, the two figures that kind of got moved out in the story represent the Elamite gods and goddesses, I guess.
I mean, I kind of don't blame Vishta for not, you know, wanting to come out in the party, because, like, everyone's freaking drunk.
Yeah.
And I think even the mindset in the party is like, you can do whatever you want. Like, there won't be any consequences.
Well, unless you're the queen, then if you don't parade yourself around naked for the king and everybody that he wants to share your beauty with, then you got to find a new job.
Yeah. And, so after Ishtar, I'm sorry, not Ishtar, after Esther replaces her, Mordecai tells her, like, you know, don't get too comfortable, because this guy Haman has basically rolled the dice and decreed that all the Jews are going to die, and you're in the capital with the king, but that doesn't mean you're going to survive because you're Jewish. Haman wants to kill all these people, all the Jews, wants to commit genocide. And then Esther convinces the king that, you know, if this goes forward, that she herself is going to die and Mordecai is going to die. And apparently Mordecai had already saved the king's life, right? He had heard some palace guards that were going to commit mutiny and kill Xerxes, and he tells the king, you know, what's going to happen, and they hang those people. And so the king's life is saved in a way. And of course, because the king's drunk, he doesn't remember this until, like, the last minute.
Yeah, it's like one of his servants is, like, recounting him the story, and then he says, wait, did we help this guy, or like, what did we do for him saving my life? And then he's just like, well, nothing. He never came to claim his prize or whatever. It's like, and Haman's about to hang the guy? I don't think so.
Right. So Haman, of course, ends up getting going to the gallows. And after that, if I understand it correctly, Mordecai is given the king's ring, which is essentially a seal to stamp legal scrolls. And so after he has the seal, he is told, go ahead and write a new decree, a new law. He brings all the scribes together, and they say that the new law is that instead of all the Jews dying on this date, I think it was the 14th of Adam, what's going to happen is the Jewish people in all of the province, you know, from Egypt up to Turkey or wherever, they're going to be allowed to attack their adversaries.
Yeah, from India to Ethiopia. That was the phrasing.
Right. You know, a huge area.
Like 127 provinces, you know? Yeah, I kind of like the part where, like, he sends out the original decree where he says, you know, everyone can, you know, attack the Jews and purge the Jews because Haman convinced him to do it. And then he can't necessarily reverse a king's order, but what he can do is say, make a new decree where the Jews have all the rights to defend themselves and, you know, attack any of the attackers back, and then they wouldn't be punished at all. So
it's kind of like
and then we get this line where it's like, and many of the people of the land became Jews, for fear of the Jews fell upon them.
Right.
It's kind of like a gang.
That's a huge point that is being glossed over, right? Like, from India to Ethiopia, many of the people of the land became Jews, for fear of the Jews fell upon them. And that's an interesting end point for this whole book. And then they killed 500 people in the palace and hung the 10 sons of Haman on his gallows that he built for Mordecai. And Mordecai got Haman's house. And this like, we glossed over the amount of courtship that Esther put into to get Xerxes to make this decision in the first place.
It
and
also,
Xerxes was like, I'll give you half my kingdom. What do you want?
It also glosses over the fact that he not only, like, permits or sanctions a civil war, but he basically initiates it single-handedly, like with Haman's manipulation as well. But he's basically saying, kill all of these people, also all of these people, defend yourselves and kill them back. Like, there's where do you go from there? He's just telling people it's time for civil war. And that was just a top-down thing. So that's pretty nutty, if you ask me.
Yeah, we've come a long way from laws like that.
Xerxes didn't seem like the greatest king, and there wasn't really any kind of balance of power. It was like, if the king decrees it, you do it. And if the king's vizier decrees it with the king's seal, you do it. And don't ask questions. But the decree that Mordecai wrote kind of reminds me of maybe like the first stand your ground law. Like,
right,
I'm gonna stand here. If you attack me, I'm gonna kill you. And the 10 people behind me are gonna like back me up.
Yeah.
But it wasn't even stand your ground. It was like rage, like purge sirens going off. Like, just this little messenger shows up into your town one day. Everything's calm, everything's fine. And then, like, here's a letter. And now everybody's killing each other.
Yeah, it was confusing. Because the way it was written sounds like if you're being attacked, then you can fight back. But then it goes on and seems like the Jewish people just go through and ransack these towns.
This is why people shot messengers.
That's a good point. It's like
if you don't have any new information come in, you can maintain the status quo.
It's like, what do you do as like the mayor of your town, let's say, and someone comes into town, it's time to kill everybody, folks. Oh yeah, you can kill yourselves back, and like, let's just put this in the fire and pretend we didn't receive it. We'll just maintain peace in this province.
Like, what guy's walking out onto the pulpit and be like, the king says kill, and then the whole audience going, okay. You savages.
It says a lot.
You're all just pretending to be shoemakers up until now. You just wanted to kill each other in cold blood.
I guess that says a lot about like what tensions would have already existed at the time, though. Like, that couldn't have happened to a society where everybody was getting along. Like, if the Jews are still trying to maintain their faith, then they would have naturally had a problem with everybody else around them anyway, because they're like, we can't like interact and mate or breed with them. We have to stay within our own culture to please God, or, you know, we're doing it wrong kind of thing.
I mean, they're kind of a weird lot, because Persia's taken over these vast territories and the Jewish people have been kind of consumed by that, originally by Babylon, and then the Persians defeated Babylon.
Right.
And so in a way they're outsiders, but they view everybody else as outsiders too.
Yeah.
They were allowed to go back to Jerusalem, you know, because we saw that in the previous right. chapters, but not everybody did that. Some people like Mordecai and Esther stayed behind in this new land.
Well, it's like we see today, right, across North America. Like there are planes taking people back to Jerusalem, and there are Jews that have chosen to live in North America and all over the world. And they've blended their cultures with other cultures. And God was furious.
Another thing about...
That's why we have a pandemic right now.
Well, maybe that fury is coming out in the next chapter of Job. Like, yeah. God's pissed off having a poker match with Satan. He's like, you know what? Screw these people.
That kind of ties into a lot of people's theory of why God isn't mentioned in this chapter, because like this is at a point where they'd fallen so low that they were so far from God where they couldn't even conceptualize like writing of him, but he's still ever present in the story.
Well, I think this book was probably written like, so the time period is supposed to be 100 years after the exile, so you know, 470 BC. I think this was probably written after that, maybe even 100 or 200 years.
Yeah, well, Asimov also talks about that, where there's mentions of Macedon in this book, where in the time period where some people suspect this was written, Macedon didn't really exist because Alexander's campaign is yet to happen, and it's just a very tiny city-state somewhere in Greece. So they wouldn't really have known about that until after the campaign of Alexander the Great. So Asimov suggests that this was written sometime after Alexander came along.
It also kind of picks up on the thread that the Jewish people are persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're being persecuted in their home by the Babylonians, and then hundreds of years later, they're being persecuted abroad by the Persians. They're about to get basically all killed.
Yeah.
And it provides a justification for
you skip rebellion. You skip the part where they were oppressed by the Egyptians and then the Canaanites.
Wow.
And then, you know, afterwards, the Greeks, the Macedonians, right? So it keeps going. And then we can talk about the Third Reich, like we've already mentioned. They've had a rough go of things.
That persecution, the momentum of that is going to keep going, because when we get up to the time of the temple of Jerusalem around the year of Jesus, the Jewish people are revolting again. And so it's giving this book, in a way, I feel, is giving a voice to that rebellious spirit.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking that's a really, like, another good point of why this was kept in the Bible, because it encapsulates that, like, a part of Judaism so clearly. Like, we can't just, you know, go with the flow. We bow to no man. We bow only to God. And then if we're not sticking to our principles, then, like, we're not doing the right thing. And I think reading this story just kind of reinforces that idea more than, like, any of the other stories that we've actually read so far. Like, that sense of rebellion is really important, and this one really, it really just captures that. And then they said, well, this is a perfect story about our religion, so it really belongs in the Bible, it belongs in scripture and everything.
And I think we'll see in the next book of Job that you can rebel against corrupt governments, corrupt men, but if you try to rebel against God himself, like, you've crossed a line.
Right.
Nah. We won't see that in the next book. But we certainly will see it at other points. Job does not rebel against God. Job is God's greatest servant.
Yeah, okay, I stand corrected. You're right, he doesn't rebel against God.
That's the whole thing.
I guess what I was trying to say is that, you know, God can essentially, like, crush you, and so it puts the fear of God in you.
Yeah, certainly puts the perversion of God in you. Then you make a bet with the devil to punish you on a whim to prove a point that has no relation or understanding that you could ever possibly conceptualize, and you just have to do good and love God.
Okay, but we're not talking about Job yet. These are spoilers. I know you're the expert, but...
I'm not. It's just, like, it is very bizarre, right? Like, and it's like, well, why does God, like, he acts in mysterious ways, and you don't understand why he acts. And Job is a great book for explaining that point, in my opinion. And also, before we run away, I do want to say that you skip from Greece to the Third Reich as though the subjugation of Jews just took a 1600-year lull. And that is not the point. As we see in The Merchant of Venice with Shakespeare, something that we should put on the reading list.
Yeah, and I did a little fast forward.
Across all geographies, wherever they went, people didn't like them very much all the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, who doesn't have that problem? Who among us is from Texas and would much more quickly put a Canadian flag on their backpack when they went into Mexico than a Texas flag? Traveling across countries and borders, regardless of how much technology we have, like, I think we're always going to feel like strangers among strangers. That to me was the most salient point out of everything that you two were discussing. And it's especially now, and maybe not even especially now, maybe just always, people are battling with the notion of feeling like strangers among strangers. You know, you don't choose the nation or the race or the gender or the context of your existence. You're just born into it and you have no idea what's going on, and you're just flying through the first 15 years, 20 years. And then finally you get to this point and you start realizing, like, oh, I'm an individual among individuals, and we form a society and we're in a nation and we have a history of the lineage of my own self, and what happened? And you start looking at it, and it's mortifying. You're like, I don't even like my family. I don't even like the people I went to school with. I don't even like my country. And it's so easy to just not even identify with anything that you've been dealt. And, the Jewish people have God and they have their laws. And that's very threatening to many people because they don't care about your king's laws. And it's very empowering to have something that you take to be divine word of how to live and how to feel like you have chosen your people. And that's what we need at a variety of levels to recognize that there are choices we can make and to fight for equality and positivity.
I mean, it's kind of exclusionary because you can't just become a Jew, right?
Think you can.
Can you? I mean, it's a genuine question I was
I
thinking
think
about. Like, can you become a, can
I don't know if
anybody
you get
join
into
the
the most
club?
innermost circle of Orthodoxy Jew.
Well, I've definitely heard of people converting to Judaism to like marry someone else in the faith because they wouldn't marry outside of Judaism. So there definitely
Yeah.
is conversions, but I think there's a quite a few steps for men in particular. I think they do
Oh, right.
something there. Yeah,
There's
gotta.
some memorizing of Torahs and becoming a Jewish man and rituals and rites and ceremonies and ordeals. And I think that that's critical. Without them, it wouldn't be anything. You wouldn't become anything without that.
Right.
Like when you become an adult and you try to make a new friend and you try and make plans and you forget about them and weeks go by and it's hard to make consistent plans. But then you think about your friends that you've always had since your childhood, or it's like you were growing. It was an ordeal unto itself. It was put so deep into your mind that why wouldn't you think of them and reach out to them? You instinctively text and keep up with that some sort of cycle of those closest to you. And it's hard to do that when you're older, because it's not as big of an ordeal making friends. It's not as big of an ordeal making belief choices and cultural directions. It takes a lot of conscious attention.
Yeah, and that all ties into another topic that we talk a lot about on this podcast, like the becoming a man, like that coming of age story, right? Like we don't really have much of it in our culture anymore, but when you look at these really strict faiths like Judaism, like you do have these like checkpoints, for lack of a better term, to say like, oh, this is like the bar mitzvah is a turning point. Like, you become something at that point in your life. But, for those of us who don't really have that, like, we're not part of the Spartan culture that leaves their children in a cave overnight to fend for themselves. And if they survive, then they're a real man. Like, maybe there is a lot to learn from stories like this and the Bible and the faiths in general to really become who we're meant to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I
Yeah.
didn't mean to insinuate that the exclusion of other people into the Jewish group was a bad thing, because in a way that makes it more meaningful. You
Well,
know,
yeah,
it.
I think there might be something to be said along the thread that the denominations and the diversification of the church is a necessary evil, and that after a certain point, much like six or seven people can't maintain a good conversation, there's only so big that you can make the body of the church before it becomes, it splits, right? It
Diluted.
becomes, is it mitosis? Is that one? Is that the word? Where a cell divides? Because you get enough people with differing views that they get together, they niche off, and then they start wanting to change things. Whereas you have thousands of small churches across a single town in some situations in America, you can have a good community, and it doesn't take many people to have a good community, but it certainly takes more than an individual being an island to get the benefits that come from faith.
Yeah. And I guess it would, I don't really know how I feel about it, but like, there's the one option of you could join the Jewish faith and like jump through all those hoops, and then there's the option of becoming a born again Christian, where all you really have to do is go to the beach one day, tell someone that you found faith in God, get your head dunked in, and then they say you're saved as long as you, you know, keep your faith and keep going to church or whatever it is.
Well, it's like it's almost to the point where it makes most sense to go to the church that's just closest to you, right? Like, as long as everybody followed the same sort of basic premises and weren't too gung-ho about converting you to all of their nuances, it'd be nice to be able to go to the potluck on Sundays and love people that are close to you and very, very convenient. And all of that's gone when you go online. There's no potluck and there's no big spread and huge Christmas tree decorating and play that gets put on when you go to an online church. And I've always loved my online connections, but I've always really valued the material world and the bond that is experienced when you put a human body next to a human body. It's just like within 50 feet even. It's like, oh, this is real. Hello, I can
Yeah, it's a good point. I know when we started this odyssey of reading the Bible, I had mentioned that I used to go to church and be saved and all that stuff. And even though I don't believe that, I tend to align more with like an agnostic or atheist viewpoint, I still enjoy going to those communities. Going and singing and seeing other people and shaking hands or hugging, you know. Even if I'm not deeply embedded in that culture, it's, you know, it's an important part of being an integrated person to be part of some sort of community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, it's like a Warped Tour or Comic Con. I guess Warped Tour is not a thing anymore. That's a bad example, but...
Yeah, pick your god or accumulate as many idols as you can to fill the hole that he leaves.
Oh, jeez.
That's a good one.
Gotta write that one down.
I think that's a good place to end if you don't have any anything else to add.
That's good for me.
Well, if you're new around here, you should check us out at our website at bookwave.club. We're on YouTube and we're on all the podcast websites through Anchor. You can drop us a donation if you're feeling kind, and like, comment, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. May the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Try to do some random acts of kindness.